Good morning, everybody. I'm Tim Burkett, the guiding teacher here, and our speaker this morning, I would like to introduce. Some of you know him well, some of you have never met him. Ben Connolly, he's been practicing here for close to 10 years. He's been a priest in training here for about a year and a half. He just finished teaching a course in Fundamentals of Buddhism, and he's going to be teaching an advanced course this summer on Yogacara Buddhism. So, Ben, you're on.
Thanks, Tim. Good morning. And thank you to Leo Hansen for providing such a beautiful meditation in sound on the shakuhachi flute. Before we start, I just invite you to join me in the hope that since there might be some snow coming, that people may experience this storm less as a series of inconveniences and more as an engagement with something really pretty amazing. So the topic for today that I'll be talking about is right effort. Right effort being one of the earliest components of Buddhist teaching. It comes out of the Eightfold Path, which is one of the most central elements of early Buddhism and is still pretty important to a lot of people around here these days. I'm going to read sort of a paraphrase of the teaching on what right effort is from way back, about 2,200 years ago. Right effort is letting go of harmful states of mind, preventing the arising of harmful states of mind, sustaining beneficial states of mind, and encouraging the arising of beneficial states of mind. So when we say right in right effort, people will explain this many ways, but I think a nice way to think of right in terms of the Eightfold Path, right is something which is not conducive to suffering. It's conducive to wellness, and it's conducive to the alleviation of suffering. So the Eightfold Path being the method that the Buddha taught for people moving towards a position of non-suffering, the right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, our topic for today, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Now, the first teachings of Buddhism could be described as a program of action for the transformation of human consciousness from something which experiences suffering to something which does not. So, although many different kinds of teachings come up in Buddhism, and we may talk of some of them today, the earliest idea really was just changing human consciousness. So it's very psychological, and I found right effort to be kind of like the most psychological of the steps in a way, because it really is like we're just going to move, we're going to apply our effort to moving from the kind of states of mind that include suffering to those which don't. One of the things I like about the Eightfold Path is its vagueness in one regard, which is it never says whether the alleviation of suffering we're talking about, or in the case of right effort, when it says preventing the arising of harmful states of mind, it doesn't say in oneself or in others. It just says preventing the arising of states of mind. So this is where Buddha encouraged us to direct our efforts. How can we help people to be well? And this is because, you know, the mind is really like the primary element of interest to the Buddha. He, you know, in the Eightfold Path, he suggests in right view when he explains that there's suffering in life and it's caused by attachment and desire. He says what we're worried about is your mind. What we're worried about is the fact that we construct suffering. And this is not the normal human way. The normal human way is to view external objects as the problem. The goddamn storm that is going to make it hard to get to work tomorrow. Instead of seeing, oh, the problem is the goddamn. The problem is me deciding there's something wrong with what's happening. So, now right effort, well, we're doing something. Finally, we're going to do something. I came to the Zen Center, normally everyone just sits still for all the time. Finally, I get to do something. Good. But it's interesting because right before right effort, you have right speech, right action, and right livelihood, which are the clearly active components of the Eightfold Path. So those are the things that it says, okay, here you're supposed to speak in a way that's kind and true. And you're supposed to conduct yourself in a way that's conducive to people's well-being, yours and others. But this effort, when he says effort, it's about effort to work with the mind. So he's directing the attention to our psychological condition. Now, right effort comes right before mindfulness and meditation. Because although mindfulness and meditation practice, if you come in and you look at everyone doing it here, you go, well, that's a bunch of people doing nothing. And if you look inside their heads, many of them may be thinking, why am I doing nothing? What is the value of this? That happens. Am I the only one who ever thinks, shouldn't I be reading a book or something? This putting right effort in this position in the Eightfold Path demonstrates that it's going to take some effort to do this. And most people, I think, find that it really does take some effort to find yourself here sitting in the morning, or to make it to a retreat, or to make it to your cushion at home every day before you go to work. And so this gives us some encouragement, because everything in the Eightfold Path is, if you apply your effort to it, is right effort, because the whole thing is about transforming your consciousness from something which experiences suffering to something which doesn't. So in the most general sense, right effort is speaking kindly. It's acting kindly. It's making your living in a way that's conducive to the overall well-being of the world. It's doing meditation. It's being attentive to what you're doing right now. It's turning your heart. It's turning your heart towards what matters, which is the overall well-being of the world, instead of what matters, which is how soon am I going to get to work through this snowstorm, for example. So I thought of a funny little example of right effort. Sometimes, you know, when it rains and I'm outside, I get a little agitated. As I get wet, I think, I do not want to be wet. I do not want to arrive wet. I don't want to be wet right now. And so then maybe I start traveling very rapidly to get where I'm going. And in my mind, most importantly, is thinking, oh, I don't like this. I don't want this to be this way. I did not want to be wet at work. So one time, Martin and I were strolling in Loring Park, as we have done many times. We were walking along, and suddenly it just began torrentially raining. It just, you know, it was like we just jumped into a waterfall. And you know, there's this little moment where I think we we both thought, now, how far are we from Martin's apartment? And how fast could we get there? But we both just made a mutual decision that now we were going to be wet. And that was pretty much the way it was. And so we just walked at our usual pace for about 10 minutes through the hammering rain and conversed and enjoyed ourselves. And at the time, it wasn't like we thought, oh, my Dharma brother, let us do right effort. But at the same time, our practice informed how we lived. So there's a moment of decision. There's a moment of decision available when you see, oh, I could become really agitated and annoyed by what's happening, and you can just choose not to do it. That's possible. You can just say, I think instead I'll enjoy life. Sometimes. Sometimes that's possible. But it is, you know, a possibility that we probably don't take as much as we could. I feel like just reading this definition of right effort again, just the early teachings were incredibly repetitive. I have the full version here, and I'm very kindly not going to give you the unbelievably repetitive version, but I'm going to repeat it a little bit, because this is the style of the teaching. Right effort to prevent the unwholesome that has not yet arisen in oneself, to let go of the unwholesome that has arisen in oneself, to bring up the wholesome that has not yet arisen in oneself, and to maintain the wholesome that has arisen in oneself. So it was kind of interesting. We just had a class on a Foundations of Practice class, you know, the Four Noble Truths. And we did an exercise, and the exercise was to, for people, or the practice was, at some point during the week, when you're really feeling like, I'm not content. I'm experiencing what in Buddhist technical terms is called dukkha. You know, something is really just, I don't agree with the universe right now. Because it's wrong, and I'm right. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? What a way to live. So anyway, the idea was when you are really feeling this, to just stop and envision or contemplate the possibility that with those circumstances, exactly as they are, you be completely at ease. At ease. Content. And I was really surprised because we did this exercise, and I really thought the purpose of it was to just help people see how they made the suffering in their life. How you could see, like, you could just kind of get a sense of, like, oh, this isn't like a necessary position to be in of suffering. It is, I can sort of envision for myself the possibility of being free from this. But the totally surprising thing was almost everyone came back and said, well, I did that, and then I felt great, and I felt at ease. It had not occurred to me that that would really happen. But I thought, I might try that myself. And for those of you who don't spend a lot of time doing Zen, I think, or for those of you who do, you might think, now, wait a minute, we're not in here just like picking and choosing how we want to be. But I think maybe we can be. I think you can just stop and say, in this moment, can I just let go? And just choose to let go of this unwholesome state? An unwholesome state just means one which is unpleasant to experience. The point is not that you're doing something wrong when you suffer. This is really important, extremely important. This is not a body of teaching about wrong and right. It's not about something you ought to do, or you should do, or I expect you to do, or your partner should expect you to do. It's about seeing that suffering is here, and opting to do something about it. Normally, instead of seeing the suffering, we see the external circumstance. We think about the problem. We think about the person that's bothering us, or the situation that doesn't agree with us, or the money that we want to have. And this Buddhist teaching says, direct your energy inward. Cultivate the peace that's available to you through your own choice. But it's really important to turn this into something that generates shame. Thinking, oh, I'm just suffering because I make my own suffering, and I should be, and there's nothing wrong with you. The other part of this teaching is the suffering is inevitable. So as I kind of said before, effort you put into any element of the Eightfold Path is going to be conducive. That is effort. That is right effort. But I'm kind of making a case here for there's also a kind of right effort, which is just in this moment opting to let go of things. Or if you feel like an enormous sense of love and appreciation, you can go, oh, I'll keep doing that. That's good. Love and appreciation is an allowed emotion in our tradition, I think. Very good. So, also another side here is that it's really important for people's bodies and people's minds to process painful emotional states. And so it's important to be careful with this idea that I'm talking about here, because it's not about suppressing or repressing or correcting yourself. So maybe you feel some suffering and you say, oh, can I let go of this? And really, if that doesn't just happen, you may want to then just turn your attention to being mindful of the experience of suffering that you're having. Because we really don't want to just be pushing aside our emotional energy, because that's dangerous and it's harmful. And so this is kind of a weird balance that we have to work. Just being with, and the just being with teaching is the one we receive much more here at this place. And it's central to our practice, just being with whatever is arising. So I recall, you know, when I first came to Zen Center, I came here mostly because I was just exhausted by the emotional roller coaster I was on. And I remember several years ago, there was something happening in my life that was really agitating to me. I had a lot of anger, and I had a lot of depression, and I thought there was something wrong with me. And I went up to talk to Tim. Tim, that guy. And I went up there. I had a Dokusan with Tim, so I sat down with my teacher. And I said, wow, you know, I'm just experiencing all this anger, and I'm feeling really sad, and I'm feeling ashamed. And, you know, I'm trying to do my practice, so it's like I'm trying to just, like, let the things come through and process them. But at the same time, I don't want to just indulge them. You know, if I have a stream of thoughts that's really negative, I don't want to just let that go. But I'm trying to, you know, so I'm trying to watch it, but I'm trying to not indulge it. And I don't know what I'm doing. How do I do this? And Tim's very helpful. So he said, it sounds like you're doing it. Because there's not an answer. There's not an answer. I mean, my sense, we can ask him later. My sense was, he saw that my intention was there to work through this in a way that made the least suffering for myself and others. And so he saw that intention, and he saw my effort. He saw me here in the morning doing zazen. He saw me coming up to meet with my teacher. And he said, pay attention, do your best. You're doing it. And that was very helpful. By the way, I'm no longer riding an emotional roller coaster. I was thinking, maybe I'm riding like a emotional, like a pony ride. So I want to read you a poem by Padachara, who is a contemporary of the Buddha and one of the first real big leaders of women in the Buddhist tradition. Padachara is most famous for an unbelievably tragic and disastrous series of events that befell her early in her life. That story is wrenching, and I'm not going to get into it. It was so traumatic that it caused her to become completely deranged. She wandered around the countryside naked for years, eating garbage, and she had about the social status, actually probably less social status than homeless people do in our society, because they had a very much more, even more stratified society than we do here, arguably, in India, with the caste system and all back then. But anyway, she encountered the Buddha. No one would come anywhere near her for a long time. I mean, literally, you know, you don't even get near this person because they will taint you. That's like some kind of old Indian idea. They'll be tainted with their bad mojo. But anyway, this Buddha saw her walking along, and he just walked right up to her. And what he said was, "It's time to recover your presence of mind." And she chose to devote herself to doing the Eightfold Path and to following his teachings. And she did that for a long time. And her path to awakening was very long. She had a lot of emotional damage to work through. But she did, and she became an incredibly beloved leader of a very large community of women eventually. She wrote this poem, or this poem is attributed to her. Actually, these are so old, it's kind of hard to know. But this is Padachara's poem. And in this poem, I'll just say, she kind of starts out, she points out that like people are just devoting their life to like having family and making money. Things work out for them pretty good. And then she's like, "I've totally devoted myself just to doing the Buddhist path." You know, she was like living a complete monastic life. Anyway, "When they plow their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right. I've followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? Bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed." I've read a lot of these early enlightenment poems, and "my mind was freed" is one of the least flowery sounding expressions of entrance into nirvana. But anyway, very simple. My mind was freed. The light went out. My mind was freed. Freed in this term means freed from suffering. So, I just, this first thing, the first couple stanzas, she says, "Well, I see all these guys, they're out here, they got their cool job, they got a big SUV Escalade, they got a couple cute kids in the back on their way to soccer practice. And here I am. I have devoted myself wholeheartedly to this practice. Why haven't I found peace?" Am I the only one who's ever been sitting zazen and thought, "Why haven't I found peace?" You know, sometimes zazen is very peaceful. Sometimes vast, spacious calm appears. But sometimes I'm just aggravated. I want my peace. Where my peace at? Where is my peace at? It's not here. And this is where the critique of the idea of Buddhism as being a path from suffering to non-suffering appears. Because if we think about it as a path all the time, we think, oh, I'm applying my right effort, and I'm going to do my right effort, and then I'm getting my peace. Well, we just turned our practice into the same source of suffering that everything else is, which is wanting things to be something other than what they are. So that's what we call in Buddhism aversion and attachment, right? I'm attached to the idea of being peaceful. I'm averse to the idea of being aggravated, unlike most people. And, you know, I'm attached to this idea that this will get me somewhere. And so that's why we end up with all these crazy, crazy phrases like, do worthless zazen. Say, worthless zazen. That Shohaku Okamura's teacher always said that. Shohaku was like, I love that teaching. Can you imagine hanging out with someone who barely said anything but just do worthless zazen? But he loved it because he could see that it wasn't what the practice was, not to go somewhere else. So, you know, we have normally here when we teach meditation, we basically teach mindfulness of breath. So observe your breathing. But in our tradition, we also have shikantaza, which is objectless meditation. So there's no purpose to the meditation, and there's no specific object on which we direct our attention. Just being, just sitting. If you don't have some mindfulness training, though, this type of meditation is probably just going to be sitting and thinking. So that's why we usually give some mindfulness teaching first. And that's why in a Zen monastery, everything you do from day to night is a mindfulness training. The way you eat, the way you bow, the way you go to the bathroom, the way you sleep. Because then when you sit down, you don't have a system of training. You just be, but you've already your mind has received some training in how to be still. You know, sometimes when you're practicing mindfulness of breath, or maybe doing a meditation where you repeat a mantra, sometimes it just occurs that one is not trying to construct some state of mind. One is not waiting to be somewhere else. One has no idea of which way it should be. You just find yourself, or maybe you lose yourself. There's just stuff happening, but would you even call it stuff happening? Because maybe nothing is happening. There's just, how do we, you know, I'm talking kind of strangely. That's why I put this halfway through the talk. So if you didn't know what I was talking about, you wouldn't think that at the beginning. So anyway, there can be just this profound stillness. And the stillness is really, from the early Buddhist perspective, it's the stillness of the aversion and attachment, of picking and choosing, of wanting things to be one way or the other. You sit so many times, and then sometimes you're just sitting there, and it just happens that there's no picking and choosing. Profound stillness. And so you're sitting, so you're making your effort. I'm doing my effort. But there's no effort. It's the effort that is not effort. or doing non-doing. Basic ideas of Taoism and the Mahayana Buddhism. How do we do not doing? You can't make it happen. It arises through continual practice. You keep doing these meditation practice. You devote yourself to the Eightfold Path, and then sometimes when you're making an action, there's no you making the action. Effort in which there is no effort. That's right effort. So Hongzhi is a 11th century Chinese Zen teacher. For those of you who like to keep track of these things, Hongzhi appears to me to be the clearest predecessor to Dogen in his writing style, for all you practice period people studying Dogen. Although Dogen has a pretty comprehensive knowledge of Buddhism. Anyway, Hongzhi, by many people, is considered to be sort of the origin of this idea of shikantaza, or as he called it, silent illumination, just sitting meditation, objectless meditation. This idea that instead of training people to do something that will get them to peace, what we'll do is we'll continually speak about the peace that's available in every moment. That it's here. That is actually the nature of your being already. And you're maybe just not seeing it. So anyway, given that he is sort of famous for this very different take on right effort, which is that there is no path, and right effort is non-effort, I found it interesting, having had this preconception when I read some Hongzhi. And I'll read you, I'm going to read some Hongzhi here, and I'll say this stuff is pretty dense, so you don't have to understand it all. Just let it flow over you. I'm just going to talk about a little bit of it. I'm going to read a couple little things. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. I like that, wander into the... I would like to wander into the center of the circle of wonder. Would you guys like to come with me? Sounds cool. But I was really struck by this, you must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. I like to say purify and see if anyone gets hives in here. I know some people, purity, they're like, oh no. Purity in this tradition means not having habits that cause suffering. Pretty complicated. Anyway, so... Hongzhi says if you want to enter this kind of stillness that he is obviously referring to, apply yourself to right effort. Apply yourself to things that are conducive to a mind which is not suffering, which is not promoting suffering in others. However, I'll read you another little one of these guys. These are called his practice instructions. They're little one-paragraph essays. This is called The Mind Ground Dharma Field and the Single Seed. The field of bright spirit is an ancient wilderness that does not change. with boundless eagerness wander around this immaculate wide plain. The drifting clouds embrace the mountain. The family wind is relaxed and simple. The autumn waters display the moon in its pure brightness. Directly arriving here, you will be able to recognize the mind-ground Dharma field that is the root source of the 10,000 things germinating with unwithered fertility. These flowers and leaves are the whole world. So we are told that a single seed is an uncultivated field. Do not weed out the new shoots, and the self will flower. Do not weed out the new shoots, and the self will flower. Oftentimes, when talking about this purifying and grinding down, teachers will use the metaphor of weeding in a garden. Weeding out the unwholesome so that the wholesome can come up. But here Hongzhi says, do not weed out the new shoots and the self will flower. Just be seeing whatever arises in Zazen. What if we do this practice? What happens? The flowering of the self he's talking about here is the flowering of the true self, a self with no center, non-self, the original face. Consciousness uninterrupted by picking and choosing, discriminating, judging, wanting, pushing away. The true self is everything. The separation we feel from everything else is just an idea. It's not a truth. So, these are two ways of practicing we're talking about. Both are right effort. Which way should we practice? When I was consumed by that question, I went to my teacher, and he said, you're doing it. So, you can do it, or you're doing it. Do not weed out the new shoots, and the self will flower. These are flowers. So I say, just trust yourself. And I hope you can give a little smile to each new flower. So I'd like to invite comments, questions, or poems. Oh, please.
I just see a story about your walking mind, and you're saying how you can choose which emotion to go with or to leave. But then later you said, there seems to be this almost better state where you don't choose. And that's how you ended the presentation, where there's no you just see. Is that how you see it as well? That there's one leads to the other? Or how does choice work then?
There's no clear answer to me. From looking at my own consciousness and from studying these teachings, there is no clear answer to that. So it appears to me that in my daily life, it might be more practical for me to think in terms of right effort as making it, directing myself and making a choice. and during Zazen, just being. But they're just ideas and ways of looking at things that are intended to be helpful. But neither one is really true. They're just ideas. I hope that's more helpful than harmful as an answer.
I think the thing that I am seeing is that with the first example, you're making a choice, and it's you making a choice, and it's thought-driven. And this other example of just being is encouraging you to do something, to take an action, which of course is deriving from thought. You think just be, that's a thought. But it's an activity. You know, observing is an activity.
Right.
Whereas choosing, if one day you don't have the same energy and that choice doesn't work, then it's going to cause suffering. And if you're choosing to try to maybe be more pleasant than just not being unpleasant, then it's going to lead to lifelong suffering.
Mm.
You know, pleasantness, pleasure, passion. So I think that second teaching is trying to play with not getting into those traps.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there's many traps here.
Yeah, I totally think so. I mean, the teaching of Shikantaza, all the teachings of the Mahayana, which suggest that our practices aren't, you know, this idea that it's an idea, it's not a truth, all are just so we don't get stuck on one way of doing things. Once we get stuck on one way, we're likely to make some trouble, because then that's the way, and if it's not that way, then it's wrong, and that's suffering. That's what suffering is. But at the same time, we need a way. I mean, if I just came here and all I ever got was, like, just be, I need to grow. You know, Hongzhi says, you must purify, grind down, and cure all apparent habits. But he says apparent habits. Because it's just the fact that they're habits is not true. It looks like a habit to me. We make a narrative out of experience, and we say that's a habit. That's a very useful thing to do, but it's not true. It's not the truth. But it doesn't mean it's not very useful. Yes.
I just wanted to comment on Shokaku's teacher who had said, what was it, pointless meditation?
Worthless Zazen.
And right effort. And for myself, when I have times of what I might perceive as being bad meditation, it's still good meditation. Because it illustrates to myself how my mind works when I'm on or off the cushion, the constant wanting to do something or get something. So it's very insightful. A bad meditation is very insightful to me. And the other thing is that if I have right meditation or right effort, I won't just say, forget it. You know, if I'm at home meditating, I won't say after 5 minutes of bad meditation, forget it. I'm just going to get up and do something. Great effort is sticking with it through the difficulties. And I find, especially on retreat, after so much meditating, eventually the brain, my mind, runs out of things to think about. I have to think about everything there is. And I am mentally dead when it comes to thinking after, you know, a couple of days of meditating. So, great effort. Just stick with it. And don't beat yourself up for bad meditation.
Yeah, for sure. It's like if someone's teaching you how to write, you're going to write, most of what you write sucks. This is the way it is. You know, any writer will tell you that, but the practice, the commitment to the practice is what matters. If you commit to the practice, you will experience a profound transformation of yourself from someone into someone who suffers less. It happens. That's, you can choose to do it. So I totally concur.
My lepers is one of the Eightfold Path, which I focus with that category. But understanding that's also that there's three chunks.
Oh, yes.
And right effort, there's what's it, right understanding part.
Would you like me to elucidate that?
Yeah.
Okay, so the Eightfold Path is often broken into the threefold training, which is just a simpler way of looking at it. So right view and right intention, which basically means seeing that there's suffering, there's a way out of suffering, which is the practice of the Eightfold Path. And right intention, which is saying, I want to do that. I'm going to wake up my heart's desire to see less suffering in the world. That is the first of the threefold trainings, which are generally called Shraddha, or faith. The faith in this tradition is that you can make less suffering in the world. I know it's a leap. So there's your Shraddha, your faith. Shraddha is the Sanskrit. And then you have Shila, which is ethics, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So ethical action. And then you have, they usually call the third training Samadhi. Yeah, Samadhi, which is kind of funny because that's this. Well, I won't get into it. But anyway, Samadhi, which means basically meditation, you could say. So right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation are lumped together generally as meditative practices. And I think it's because they deal most directly with just looking at the mind. So you're mindful, so when you make right effort, you cultivate healthy states of mind. When mindful, you just see what the state of mind is. And in Samadhi, your mind is concentrated, and you just get to disappear.
I think in terms of also, they kind of help each other, come up with the group, and you hit one, you'll cycle through the others, and you'll get a deeper place as you circle back. I think with the right effort, that's what is into this too, where, you know, some of the confusions about how to interpret it would.
Yeah, you do the practice, and it happens. Sometimes right speech is not right speech. You just talk in a way that's really nice. You know? It's not like, I'm doing right speech. You just happen to have learned how to speak in a way that's kind and helpful. For sure.